Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
I'm Jim Dolan. Thanks for joining me for another hour of old-time radio here on the RTC Weekly Download. Today, we're going back behind the scenes in Hollywood, both in radio and the movies. We'll start off with a program from 1941. This is called Amusing Stories Behind the Radio.
Radio's own show, Behind the Mic. Radio. With a switch of your dial, radio brings you tragedy, comedy, entertainment, information, education, a whole world at your command. But there are stories behind radio, stories behind your favorite programs and favorite personalities and radio people you never hear of. Stories as amusing, dramatic, and as interesting as any make-believe stories you hear on the air. And that's what we give you. The human interest, the glamour, the tragedy, the comedy, and information that are behind the mic. And now presenting a man whose name has been a symbol of the best in radio since the beginning of broadcasting, Graham McNamee.
Thank you, Gilbert Martin, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience. This afternoon, Behind the Mic brings you true amusing stories about radio from the collection of A.L. Simon, a radio columnist, the sound effect of the week, a human interest story behind a broadcast of Alma Kitchell's. More amusing fluffs or mistakes made by your favorite announcers. We salute a program you love, one that starred songstress Sylvia Fruce. We answer letters from listeners, and finally, you will hear what happens when a daytime serial needs fixing up, as told by scriptwriter and consultant Bill Rapp, editor of True Story Magazine. There are other people besides those connected with the production of Behind the Mic who make collections of amusing stories behind radio. For instance, there is Al Simon, conductor of the radio column Twisting the Dials, which is syndicated throughout the country, and radio instructor at Long Island University. He's going to bring you some of these stories. And now, Al Simon. Al, how long have you been collecting stories behind radio?
Since about 1937, Graham, when I wrote letters to practically all the stations in the country and asked them to send me stories, particularly amusing stories behind radio.
Oh, what are you collecting them for?
Eventually, in collaboration with Ben Hall. I want to make a book out of these stories and call it Fun on the Air.
Well, suppose we dramatize a few of these true behind-the-mic stories that have been sent to you, Al, huh?
That's what we're here for, Graham.
Go ahead.
To start off... One day, the harried girl at the information telephone at KFI, KECA, Los Angeles, heard...
Madam, I've got a little bet you can settle. I'd like to know where KFI gets the correct time.
From Western Union.
Where does Western Union get the correct time?
From the U.S. Naval Observatory in Arlington.
Where does the Naval Observatory get it?
From the stars.
Where do the stars get it?
From the KFI time signals.
Oh.
That was one of my favorites. Here's another one, Graham. This story concerns Arthur Godfrey, radio commentator. A couple of years ago, a beer concern in Washington, D.C. decided that radio would help their sales pick up in hot weather. They acquired time on Godfrey's sundial program and sat back to view the results. About 3 weeks later, Godfrey received the following telegram.
You're good. Your program is better. Our beer sales are even better than that. We can't fill any more orders. You're fired.
Here's another one from my collection, Graham. Eddie O'Shea, the sound effects man at WTIC Hartford, once fired a shot during one of the popular mystery dramas broadcast over that station. The shot was supposed to have killed the villain instantly. A moment later, O'Shea tripped over a wire and accidentally fired the revolver a second time. This could have ruined the drama, but the actor at the mic thought quickly and said,
Boy, has this place got an echo.
That's all right, Al. How about another one?
Well, a couple of years ago, out in Butte, Montana, there was a show called Barnum Was Right, which featured dramatizations from San Francisco's police records. After a brief opening theme and announcement, a voice would say,
There's a fool born every minute, and a chisler to take him.
At station KGIR one night, the program preceding Barnum Was Right ran overtime, and the announcer had to rush through a long local announcement advertising bargains at a local store.
This is one of the greatest sales that Smith's Bargain Basement has ever run. You'll get such bargains as genuine full-fashioned silk hose at 36 cents a pair, aluminum pants for 17 cents, hand-cut glassware at a new low price, and other equally good bargains. And now for Barnum Was Right.
There's a fool born every minute and a chiseler to take him.
But one of my real favorites concerns a nervous speaker on a Chicago station who picked up his speech with the last page first and started his talk right off.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, good night.
I wonder if you can sit down in those aluminum pants. Well, anyway, good afternoon to you, Al Simon, and thanks for those amusing stories. We hope to have you back on this program a few weeks from now with a lot more of them. The sound effect of the week. From time to time, Behind the Mic presents some unusual sound effect which was used on the air and tells exactly how it was done. This week, we again answer requests of our radio audience to explain certain common sound effects. One correspondent asks us how the sound of somebody walking up and down stairs is made. The sound is this. It is made by our sound man simply walking up and down seven or eight steps of a miniature stairway, especially constructed for this purpose. Another listener asks how a baby cry is made. Well, a baby cry is made by one of two ways. Either by having an expert crier weep into the mic and flood the studio with tears, like this. Or simply by playing a phonograph record of a bawling infant. Several months ago, we showed how this same record, played at slow speed, is also used for the sound of a man having a bad case of pink snakes, we'll call it. The same record played at slow speed. And finally, we received a request from one bloodthirsty fan who wanted to know how the sound of a person being beheaded by the guillotine is created. This is done by using a series of pulleys. Attached to one end of the rope, which runs through these pulleys, is a weight, which is released as the pulley is raised and falls with, we hope, a sickening thud, which makes the sound of raising the guillotine knife and dropping it. To make the sound of the head falling, after a deadly silence, you drop into the basket a Persian melon for the head of an aristocrat, for a proletarian, a cantaloupe, and for the hoi polloi, a squash. Now, this time, a sustaining program, we'll drop a grapefruit. Head bobbed. Ooh. Ago, we had as a guest Alma Kitchell, conductor of Alma Kitchell's Briefcase and Alma Kitchell's Streamline Journal. She brought us a most absorbing human interest story, and since then I've learned that she knows many others. So here's Alma with another story of what radio meant to one listener. Alma Kitchell. Come in, Alma.
Graham, as you know, or perhaps you don't, the theme of one of these programs of mine is what radio means to its listeners.
Of course I do. I listen every day.
Thanks. After one broadcast, I received such a human, touching letter from a widow. She told me that she'd been having considerable trouble with her son. She was worried. For instance, at night, after supper, she'd say to him,
Bob, where are you going now?
I'm going out with the gang.
I wish you'd find some new friends. I don't like those boys, especially that Bart boy. He's a bad one.
Oh, Hank Bart's all right.
No, he isn't. It was only by the skin of his teeth that he wasn't sent to reform school last year for breaking into Russo's grocery store. I wish you'd stay home in the evening once in a while, Bob.
What is there to keep me home here?
Well, she wrote me further that Bob had been in a little trouble in school also. The principal had asked her to come to see him.
Unless your son changes his ways, I'm sure he'll end up in the reform school.
Yes, but what can I do?
Well, for one thing, he ought to develop some new interests. Something that will take him away from the group of boys that are now his companions. Those kids are pretty bad youngsters.
I know. He's out with them every night when he's supposed to do his homework. He just won't stay at home.
Well, there ought to be some way of making him stay home. Have you a radio?
No.
Why don't you get one? A small one. You know, the radio might not only keep him home listening to it, but it may help to develop some new interest.
She wrote me that she did buy a radio, and her son started listening to music, and being a youngster, particularly to dance bands. Very soon he developed such an interest in music that he wanted to get into the school band. But of course he couldn't play because his mother couldn't afford a musical instrument for him. The principal again came to the rescue and got him the loan of an old trumpet. The lad was thrilled and practiced diligently. Well, to make a long story short, Graham, he not only became one of the star performers of the high school band, but on graduation he formed his own dance orchestra. And who knows, someday he may be one of the big leaders. And there's a youngster who might have wound up in a reform school.
Well, Alma, that's another swell example of the way in which radio influenced its listeners for the better. And thank you for another grand story, Alma Kitchell. Oddities in Radio, offering odd little true behind-the-mic stories that help make radio sometimes amusing, sometimes exasperating, but always interesting to the people in it. This week's oddity, we once more present some fluffs and amusing mistakes made by your favorite announcers. Most of these fluffs have been supplied by Al Simon from his collection. Announcer Sheb Martino, giving a time signal on station WDZ in Tuscola, Illinois, once said,
"The correct time is 10 of 10. No, I mean 10 after 10. Well, anyway, it's somewhere around 10 o'clock.
An announcer on a New York station said,
"Tonight, fair and cooler, followed by tomorrow and Saturday."
On station WMBO, Auburn, a new announcer introducing a soprano soloist said,
"And now we hear Miss Gilbert singing her interpretation of that beautiful old Jewish ballad, Makushla."
On station KDKA, announcer Bill Sutherland introducing a very large, stout soprano made this slip:
"Our singer is well known in musical circuses."
And Ted Using once came out with this one:
"Here come some government dignitaries, all of them high."
Finally, an announcer at WMBO doing a time signal said,
"The time will be 2:30 p.m. at the sound of the musical goat."
We in radio believe that radio has a tradition of which it can well be proud, a tradition of good programs that linger fondly in our memory. So each week, we bring you a star or a part of a program you used to hear, a program you loved. This afternoon, behind the mic, salutes a young lady who has long been a radio favorite and is not only every bit as good as ever, but maybe just a little bit better. Our guest is Sylvia Fruth. Sylvia, what are you going to sing?
Do I worry, Graham?
If you do, you're crazy.
Perhaps you wonder how I feel about your sudden change. I thought at last that this was real, but since you're acting strangely, do I worry 'cause you're stepping out? Do I worry 'cause you've got me in doubt? Though your kisses aren't right, do I give a bag of beans? Do I stay home every night and read my magazine? Am I frantic 'cause we've lost the spark? Is there panic when it starts turning dark, and when evening shadows creep, do I lose any sleep over you? Do I worry? You can bet your life I do. Do I worry 'cause you're stepping out? Do I worry? You've got me in doubt, though your kisses aren't right. Do I give a bag of beans? Do I stay home every night and read my magazines? Am I frantic 'cause we've lost the spark? Is there panic when it starts turning dark? When evening shadows creep, do I lose any sleep over you? Do I worry? You can live your life. I do.
Yeah, Sylvie, I think it's even a little bit better. Gal, how you can put a song over. Thank you. Letters from listeners. Each week we invite the listeners of Behind the Mic to write us questions about radio, and almost every week the questions we consider to be of most general interest we have answered on the air. This afternoon's questions will be answered by Behind the Mic in the person of our announcer, Gilbert Martin.
Thank you, Graham.
Ann Sims out on Yukon Wilcox asks, are there any women directors in radio?
Yes, Graham, there are a few women directors in radio, and several weeks ago we had one of them as a guest on this very show. Although there aren't many such gals, they are all very competent. And believe me, they have to be, as the competition with the male sex in this field is terrific.
Philip M. Lewis of New York City writes in to ask this question. I am told that a number of comedians have dress rehearsals before audiences to test out their gags. And yet some of them, the gags, not the comedians, die during the actual program. If the gags have been tested, why is this so?
Well, no two audiences are alike, and jokes which get laughs from one group of people will not always evoke laughter from another. Now, there are other reasons why jokes do not get laughs besides their not being funny. For instance, during the telling of a joke, somebody walks across a stage and takes the studio audience attention from the comedian, which, of course, will kill a gag.
Ralph Vogel of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania writes, when a program preceding yours runs into your time, as happened a few weeks ago when Winston Churchill was speaking, how do you make sure your program will come out on the dot, as yours did? After all, you didn't know how long Churchill was going to speak, and he occupied 6 or 7 minutes of the time allotted to Behind the Mic.
Well, in the case of Mr. Churchill, it's true we didn't know how long he was going to speak, but we had the program so timed that we knew by taking out one portion of it, we'd save 5 minutes. By taking out another portion, 10 minutes, and so on. We didn't know until the moment we went on the air exactly how long our program would have to be, and as prearranged, we cut to make up the lost time. And I might say this is the usual procedure in such situations.
Ralph Adams of Collinsville, Connecticut, requests this information for a friend. Does John J. Anthony, conductor of the Goodwill Hour, answer programs by mail, and how does one address letters to him?
Mr. Anthony informs us that he does not attempt to give solution to personal problems by mail. Letters sent to him should be addressed to John J. Anthony in care of the station through which he is heard, and the mail will be forwarded.
Jan Hart of Newark, New Jersey, wants to know if your orchestra leader, Ernie Watson himself over there, is the same man who composed that novel music for the old Popeye program.
And that answer is yes. Ernie not only composed the Popeye music, but he has composed and arranged for such orchestra leaders and orchestras as Paul Whiteman, the Philadelphia Symphony, Rubinoff, Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw, Tommy and Jimmy Dorsey, and at present is composing for various NBC orchestras and programs.
Ralph Adams of, Ruth Starr, not Ralph Adams, of Beaumont, Texas, wants to know what happened to Schlepperman of the Jack Benny program.
Well, Schlepperman, whose real name is Sam Hearn, appears intermittently as a guest on various radio programs. A few weeks ago, he was a guest on the Good News program, and he also makes numerous vaudeville appearances.
And that's the news. Thank you, Gilbert Martin. daytime serials play a mighty important part in radio, and there are very vital writing problems in these shows, problems that arise when the script goes stale and listeners start to fall away. In such a case, a story consultant is often called in to advise on how to fix the script. Here is one of the best of these story consultants to tell you all about it. Besides being a radio consultant, he is editor of True Story Magazine, Bill Rapp. Hello, Bill. Mic's yours. Take it away.
Thanks, Graham. But I want to say here at the beginning that a story consultant not only is called in when a script goes stale, but is sometimes called in at the start of a serial to help the author plot the story.
Well, what does a good daytime serial have to have, Bill?
A sponsor.
Oh, you're a dreamer, Bill, but aren't we all?
But seriously, a good story for a long serial must have at least two of these three fundamentals. A socially significant central theme, a group of characters who naturally generate dramatic situation after dramatic situation, and a hopeful attitude to this business of living.
When do you do most of your work, Bill?
During story conferences.
What are these story conferences like?
Well, Graham, suppose we show the audience a typical story conference designed to help out a sick script. And so that our audience can get them all straight, let's first introduce the people at the conference.
Well, I'm Martha. I write the script. It's always been successful until now.
I'm Pete, the advertising manager of the sponsor. Personally, I think the trouble with this script is that it's too highbrow.
I'm Joe. I represent the advertising agency. I'm what they call an account executive. Boy, oh boy, I hope that just because our show has lost a little popularity, the client doesn't change to another advertising agency.
I'm the story consultant, but I won't come in till later.
I'm the director of the show. I should be at the conference, but I'm not. I'm homesick, which cuts out another actor and keeps the budget of this program down.
And now, a typical story conference in an office of an advertising agency. And don't think it's exaggerated.
The thing that gets me is if you'd ever known a script in your life, and then you come in
just
here
look at that
me,
Crosley. Just take a look at that Crosley now. Look at it. Down 2 points since the last rating. And every point means millions less listeners. And why is the rating down? Why, I ask you?
Why, Pete? Because we killed Sherman Talbot.
Of course. Certainly. Look at the mail we received. This one says, "Why did you kill Sherman Talbot? He was such a fine man. He had a lovely character. We all like him, and now you've killed him. Yeah. We'll never buy your product again, and we used to eat it all the time at our home."
Isn't that awful?
Yeah, and here's another one, too, Joe. Look.
Yeah?
"It was a disgrace to kill Sherman Talbot. I resent it personally. Not only will I not eat toasted Shreddies, but I belong to the Four Deuces Bridge Club and to the Ladies Auxiliary, and I'll see that none of the members eat toasted Shreddies either."
You're right, Pete, you're right. I guess we shouldn't have killed Sherman Talbot.
Well, I'm glad we've agreed on that, at least. But who killed Sherman Talbot?
Who killed him? Why,
yes,
you know...
It was your idea, Pete. You told us your wife didn't like Sherman Talbot.
Well, she didn't.
And none of her friends liked Sherman Talbot. And that I should get rid of him once and for all. So I had to have him shot.
Yeah, well, I still think I'm right.
Yes.
But if you'd written it right, you didn't dumb it up enough.
Oh,
that was the trouble.
You're the first person who hasn't been satisfied with my writing. I've written radio for 10 years, and my scripts have always been successful.
Yeah? Then why don't you write a successful script for us? Show's going down, our product isn't selling.
Well, maybe your product isn't any good. Have you ever thought of that? Well, I...
Now, look, Martha, do you realize what you're saying?
The product is good. Now, look here, I'll have you know that we sold more toasted Shreddies last...
Where is that guy, Rapp? We're paying him to come in here and help us lick this problem. He can't even be here on time.
Bill?
Yeah, that's right. Where's Rapp?
I don't know. We should...
Oh, hello, Bill.
Sorry I'm late.
Well, Bill, we've got a real problem here.
I'll have you know that toasted Shreddies last year, Martha, we sold more...
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It's a great product. But how about it, Bill? Are you ready to help us?
Well, I spent 12 hours last night listening to records of the rise of young Dr. Pepper O'Randolph. I must have heard about 40 or 50 episodes.
Yes, well...
Do you know what's wrong with it?
Yes.
Good. What?
You killed Sherman Talbot too soon.
Too soon? I didn't think he should have been killed at all.
Well, my wife doesn't like him, and she knows her radio.
Yes, Pete, probably a lot of people didn't like Sherman Talbot. But a lot more people seem to like him.
You're right.
This Talbot was a rather nice guy before you decided to get rid of him, wasn't he, Martha?
Sure, that's the way I built his character.
And you got rid of him in about 5 weeks. That is, you changed his character and made him a heel and motivated his death all within that time.
Right.
It was done much too fast.
What do you mean, Bill?
Well, you know that many of your daytime radio serial listeners don't listen every day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them remember Sherman Talbot as being a good guy.
Right.
They didn't know that he'd become a villain because they didn't hear some of the shows in which his character was changed.
Should have listened.
So when they heard that he'd been shot, they were sorry for him. Mm-hmm. If you would have spread his becoming a heel out over 13 weeks, you would have given your listeners a chance to find out that he was a rat.
I tried to say.
Those letters you got are from women who still remembered him as being a good guy.
You're right, absolutely right. Well, what can we do now, Bill? What's the way out?
Radio reincarnation. Mm-hmm. He's got to be brought back.
What do you mean?
I had him shot, but definitely. We had him found kissing another man's wife, and the husband shot him. He's been buried.
Well, listen, can we dig him up?
Hey, that's a constructive suggestion, Pete. Dig
him
up, that's right.
I wonder if a man could be buried and then be... Wait a minute. Maybe a cataleptic fit.
Well, wait, I'll find out in a second. I'll phone my doctor.
Well, all right.
All right, phone
Hello.
The doctor.
Hello, give me a line, please.
You know, I've heard of cases.
Well, hold on a second. This fellow will know.
Unbelievable.
Hold on.
I hope he gets this guy in.
Hello? Hello, Ernie? Yeah, this is Pete. Say, Ernie, can a guy be buried in a cataleptic state and be brought back to life? How long ago was he buried? A month ago. No, I don't know him. It's a script. Yeah, he was killed. Oh. Oh, thanks. Thanks very much.
Well, goodbye. What does he say?
Now, if he was buried, he was embalmed, and nobody can survive that.
Not even on daytime radio.
Oh, well, I never thought of embalming. Sure.
Look, I figured this out.
Yeah?
The script intimated that Talbot didn't get along with his mother-in-law.
Yeah.
Right.
He believed that she was interfering in his married life.
He was.
So let's give him a double and make the double the guy who was shot.
A double?
This sort of thing happens frequently. Men sent to jail, for instance, because they looked like the real criminals.
Mm-hmm.
Now Talbot was away from home when he sees his picture printed in the papers with the startling news that he's dead. That gives him an idea.
Yeah.
His mother-in-law has been ruining his whole life. So he decided that this was a great break.
Uh-huh.
Instead of going home, he goes to Atlantic City.
That's a great idea.
Well, but listen, how are we going to get him back in the story, Bill?
Well, one day a friend comes to the house and asks how Sherman is.
Yeah.
The wife says, Sherman, don't you know Sherman's dead?
Sure, he's dead.
He died a month ago.
Uh-huh.
And the friend says, well, I must have seen a ghost then in Atlantic City only 2 weeks ago because I met him there and we talked.
Oh,
and it was Sherman, all right.
I get the idea.
So they call the Missing Persons Bureau of the police department in Atlantic City.
Mm-hmm.
A call goes out, and Sherman Talbot is located.
Sounds good to me. He doesn't want to come home on account of the mother-in-law situation.
Right. So they put a personal ad in the newspapers, and he finally answers and says that he'll come home, but no mother-in-law.
Yes, but what are we going to do with the mother-in-law?
Why not kill her?
Yes. We could. She could be hit by a taxi or have a heart attack.
Oh, no, listen, wait. You can't kill the mother-in-law.
Why not? Everybody hates her.
Yes, but you can't kill the mother-in-law.
And why not?
Because think how many people who buy our product are mothers-in-law.
Oh.
That's easy to fix.
Oh, yeah? How?
Let's not forget the fate of our fundamentals. A hopeful attitude to life.
There you are.
So instead of killing the mother-in-law, we'll reform her.
Good night.
In 13 weeks.
Reform a mother-in-law in 13 weeks? Don't you think that's too fast?
Now, let's go into that.
That is typical of an actual story conference.
Thank you, Bill Rapp, for supplying that information, for giving us a fine technical story, and for appearing yourself. Thanks, Bill. This music is that the show ran a little shorter than dress rehearsal, and rather than slow up the pace of our spot about daytime serials, we decided to fill in with music. On Behind the Mic, you will learn how songstress Alice Cornett almost lost a sponsor because she lost her southern accent. We salute a program you love that starred orchestra leader and instrumentalist Frank Novak. You will learn how mystery scripts are written. And we bring you more of the comedy, the tragedy, and the glamour that are behind the mic. This is Graham McAlee speaking. Good afternoon, all. Behind the Mic is written by Mort Lewis. Original music composed and conducted by Ernie Watson. This is the Blue Network of the National Broadcasting Company.
Well, now that we've heard some amusing stories from behind the radio, we're going to go behind the movies. from 1945. We have two episodes of this program, Behind the Scenes in Hollywood. We'll start off with the ban on sightseers in productions, and we'll follow that immediately with comparing a Hollywood studio to an industrial plant.
Bidwell McCormick takes you behind the scenes in Hollywood.
Time was when studio tours were commonplace. In the early days of Hollywood development, platforms were built around the spot where scenes were to be shot, and onlookers were charged a quarter to watch the pictures being made.
Yeah, but all that's changed now, and to even get on a lot in Hollywood, you have to just about be one of the performers or the director.
Well, not quite that bad, but that does call to mind a theater owner that I once knew, who had given such strict instructions against passing anyone in that he actually had to buy a ticket to get into his own theater.
Well, that was carrying it a little too far. But I guess this ban on sightseers is important and very necessary.
It certainly is. Just imagine how costly it would be today if production was interrupted because someone inadvertently coughed or sneezed on the set, or a child cried, or someone distracted the performer's attention.
Leave it to Butch Jenkins to hand Hollywood another surprise. Now the 7-year-old actor with the dollar-sized freckles is taking piano lessons, and he asked for them himself. American naval officers rescued by Rangers in the daring raid on the Cabanatuan prison camp on Luzon will be seen in the scenes of the Invisible Army. One of the highlights of the film will be a reenactment of the sensational raid on the prison camp.
The Magnificent Tramp is RKO's first Hollywood vehicle for the noted Mexican comedian Cantinflas. Al Herman will serve as art director. Carol Clark will design settings for Bar of Music, Frank Sinatra's next starring film. Walter Keller will be art director on Riverboat Rhythm.
And here's a personality close-up that will interest you. Betty Grable. Betty Grable is a Hollywood success because she planned it that way. She began planning almost as soon as she could toddle, and she hasn't stopped for a moment since. At the age of 4, Betty already was hoofing it with the best of them in dancing school and manhandling a saxophone when she wasn't busy plucking discords on the ukulele. In short, she was an infant prodigy and already was prattling off things theatrical and entertaining. Talent such as Betty's in those tender years doesn't go unrecognized for long. At the age of 7, Betty made her professional debut by public demand, in spite of the objections of her parents, who felt she was much too young. She went on the air and appeared with such notables in the entertainment world as Frank Fay, Ed Lowry, Jack Haley, and others. In between time, she was attending the Mary Institute, an exclusive school for girls at St. Louis, where she absorbed education in liberal dosages. It had been the habit of the Grable family to take extended vacations every summer far from home. They had been in Maine and in Florida, in Minnesota and in Canada. In 1929, they decided that Southern California might be well worth visiting. They came that summer, and the die, as far as Betty was concerned, was cast. Betty, it seemed, had a good deal to do with their decision to come to Los Angeles and Hollywood. As usual, she was planning. Her first film stint was a specialty number in Let's Go Places, made in 1930. Betty Grable is a blue-eyed, golden-haired blonde of the peaches and cream variety. She weighs 112 pounds when she isn't working, and when she is, between 112 and 117. The harder she works, the more weight she gains. At one time, while rehearsing day and night, her weight jumped to 122. She never diets and prefers steaks on her menu, although she'll eat anything and everything. She's one of the most adept dancers in Hollywood and one of the best horsewomen. She also bowls very well and plays a good game of tennis. At one time, she took up ice skating in a serious way and kept at it for a year. And now, your local announcer. Bidwell McCormick takes you behind the scenes in Hollywood.
When a prominent producer and a well-known director will go out of their way to seek new talent for the leading roles in an important production, instead of using big-name stars with established box office drawing power, they must have something very special in mind.
Yes, and I understand that's what Frank Ross, the producer, and director Mervyn LeRoy are doing in the matter of casting their forthcoming Technicolor production, The Robe.
Exactly. And they have gone about it in a big way, too, and in a manner befitting a production such as the one this promises to be, judging from a look at a very attractive packet, which came to my attention recently.
A packet? Just what do you mean?
Well, a brochure, a booklet, a printed folder. I hardly know just what you'd call it. But it is very attractive and different indeed. It is not designed to sell anything, but rather to buy something. It is a bid for new talent and is addressed to artists' representatives. The brochure is made in the form of a large filing envelope of excellent quality heavy paper and handsomely lithographed. Within and printed on separate cards about 6 by 9 inches in size is first a statement by producer Ross of the talent he is seeking. Unknown faces to portray the leading and minor roles in the picturization of Lloyd Douglas's widely read book, The Rogue. And following this is a brief but enlightening description of each characterization to be portrayed, what their part will be, and how each should look. This folder was apparently sent to all leading artist representatives or agents throughout the country, as it is also stated that the screen test will be held both in Hollywood and New York.
Well, that's going after what you want in a big way. But isn't that the way Hollywood usually does things? Whatever it is, it's in a big way. Colonel Robert L. Scott of the Flying Tigers is in the public eye again. His famous autobiography, God is My Co-Pilot, has been dramatized for the screen by Warner Brothers and is soon to be released with Dennis Morgan in the title role.
There's a possibility that Gladys Cooper, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer actress and formerly a British star, may return to the stage. She is now talking play possibilities with a noted playwright, John Van Druten.
Joan Loring, featured in Warner Brothers' Three Strangers, is by way of becoming a linguist. She's studying French and already speaks Russian and Spanish. Her great ambition is to be able to read fan letters from all over the world, including China. And now, Gertrude, will you give us the personality close-up of that all-time favorite, Jack Haley?
Jack Haley, fighting his way up from vaudeville, turns in movie houses, small stage roles, small screen roles, featured roles in stage musicals, and feature roles in stage productions that somehow did not seem to lead into prominence on the screen. His first big break came some 5 years ago when he practically stole stellar honors in Wake Up and Live. Haley is a Boston Irishman. Off the screen, he isn't at all the frozen-faced gent he seems. That's his comedy style. In real life, he is very animated. He's a fast and aggressive talker. Before an audience, he can ad-lib with anyone. But if he has time, he prepares his own speeches, vaudeville skits for radio and USO use. He writes well, also contributes funny gags to the pictures in which he appears. He has an Irish temper, Irish generosity, and a tendency to forgive readily. He's superstitious, happy most of the time, but sometimes as melancholy as a Dane. He will bore anyone to listen to the anecdotes about his children. He adores his wife and brags about his home in Beverly Hills, which he remodeled into New England style, like the homes of rich galoots he used to envy in his native Boston, Massachusetts. And now, a word from our announcer.
Bidwell McCormick takes you behind the scenes in Hollywood. Bidwell, what do you know about motion picture press agents?
Now that, Nathan, is quite a question. I have a number of very good friends, both in the studio and on the road for the motion picture companies. Theirs is a specialized and highly skilled profession. Today, the press agent is a very important man to his company, since he is the only contact between his firm and the press and radio.
He must combine the skills of a diplomat, the vision of a soothsayer, and the stamina of a plowhorse, I guess.
You're just about right there. And the present-day press representative, or studio publicity man, is a far cry from the press agent of bygone days, when one man advanced the show. That is, went ahead of the stage play and wrote and placed all the publicity. They go ahead for many of the important motion pictures today, but they are backed up with an almost inexhaustible supply of photographic art, advance and current newspaper stories, prepared advertisements, and numberless suggestions for publicity stunts prepared by the studio and home office publicity staffs, of photographers, publicity writers, and so forth, numbering from 2 to 3 in the small companies to several hundred in the larger ones.
With all that backing up, why does the contact press representative of a motion picture company have to be so thoroughly trained or experienced?
Well, to see the reams of multigraph stories, the scores of still pictures, and the many letters and telegrams he receives from his superiors, one wouldn't think that he would need a thing. But very often he does. On the whole, this material is prepared for national circulation and often has to be adapted to local situation. Besides, as I said before, the press agent is the front man for the industry and of his company in particular, and an inexperienced or shabby-mannered press representative would be like a merchant displaying his wares through a soiled plate-glass window.
Greer Garson definitely set to romance with Clark Gable in this strange adventure, and if you're wondering what's going to happen to Walter Pidgeon while Greer makes with Gable, he's going to star in The Silver King, a Drury Lane melodrama for Metro.
Someone asked Robert Young, MGM star and father of three young daughters, if he kept a scrapbook of stills from his pictures, news about himself and so forth. What, he replied, and have my young daughters a few years from now using it to paste in, over my stuff, pictures of some new Frank Sinatra? And now for today's personality close-up, we have lovely Teresa Wright. She early dreamed of becoming an actress. Usually, daughters with theatrical ambitions meet with parental disapproval. But with Teresa, it was different. Fortunately, her family sympathized with her hopes and financed two summers of professional tuition at Provincetown. This led to her understudying the leading feminine role in Our Town on Broadway, and then to playing that role in a road company that toured New England. Next, she joined another summer group in New Hampshire and got some needed training. She returned to New York that fall to snatch the acting plum of the year, the role of the young girl in Life with Father. From her triumph success in this part, she received many film offers, but turned them all down because she didn't want to spend a year doing nothing but posing for bathing art in Hollywood. However, she capitulated when Samuel Goldwyn tendered her the part of Betty Davis's daughter in The Little Foxes. And although she went back to the Life with Father cast, as soon as the picture was completed, she has since completed many successful motion picture roles in Hollywood. 5 feet 2 inches tall and weighing 110 pounds, Teresa Wright has wavy brown hair and greenish blue eyes. Looks like the typical American girl, healthy and full of fun, doesn't care for nightclubs, a great admirer of Miss Davis and Helen Hayes. And now, a word from your station announcer.
Bidwell McCormick takes you behind the scenes in Hollywood.
Few persons with whom I have ever talked, who are not directly associated with the production of motion pictures, express any conception whatever of the vastness of a large Hollywood soundstage.
Well, that's true, don't you think, about almost any great industrial plant? And that's what a Hollywood studio really is, an industrial plant in the mass production of entertainment. True, only one or two or a half dozen or so at most different productions are being fabricated at a time. But these finally emerge as hundreds of separate prints to supply as many different theaters in all parts of the country at one time. That's mass production and denotes vastness in itself.
Yes, and to make an outdoor production largely under one roof where all sound, atmosphere, sunlight, degrees of twilight and darkness can be perfectly controlled requires almost unbelievable space, too. Why, I was on a set recently on one of the larger sound stages where an outdoor scene was being photographed, and even that set, with its large real trees, its brook running through real mountain grass, its campfire with horses tethered nearby, and numerous performers, was, as one might say, lost. So great was the size of the sound stage itself.
When you speak of stage, you of course don't mean a stage in the sense that stages for plays, vaudeville performances, or even the opera are known.
Oh, no. The sound stage is a term used to describe the great soundproof building which houses the photographing of a scene or scenes. Some are comparatively small, some are large, and a few really immense. A huge auditorium, completely soundproof, and large enough to house sometimes a three-ring circus, or an apartment house, or a good-sized railway station. That's a Hollywood soundstage. It's really terrific.
A Chinese version of RKO's First Man into Tokyo will be the first screen venture of Chinese Productions Limited, a newly formed Chinese-American film company. The Amorous Ghost is the final title for the Pat O'Brien comedy drama now in production at the RKO radio studio, which was temporarily titled Man Alive. The first assignment of Rennie's RKO costume designer, following her return to the Hollywood studio from her New York visit, will be the close for the magnificent tramp, Cantinflas. Here's something to watch for, Gable and Garson's first kiss. Greer Garson, as Clark Gable's sweetheart in Strange Adventure, has to cackle like a hen, crow like a rooster, and fall flat on her face, all before Gable kisses her for the first time. Grant Withers has been signed to Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer for an important role in Dangerous Partners, in which he will be cast as a heavy.
Tagged in Hollywood as the body, gorgeous Marie MacDonald seems definitely slated for stardom as the result of her portrayal of a sirenish other woman in the Gay International Pictures romance, It's a Pleasure, Sonia Henney's first Technicolor film for RKO radio release. There's a streamlined reason for the label given Marie. She's 5 feet 6 inches tall, weighs 123 curvaceous pounds, measures 35 inches at bust and hips, and has a 23-inch waist. Really something in this girdleless age. With the exception of the first 8 months, Marie's life has been spent in America. Vienna-born, her parents brought her to Bergen, Kentucky. Then, while she was still in grammar school, moved to New York City. Upon graduation from Roosevelt High School, the glamorous Marie joined the stage in a singing and dancing spot in the George White Scandals. Later, she did a solo turn at Gotham's famous Leon and Eddie's, sang with Tommy Dorsey's band, and on the radio with Johnny Long and Charlie Burnett bands. Sent to Hollywood by talent scouts, Marie played small roles in 3 Abbott and Costello comedies. She then appeared in Lucky Jordan and Our Hearts Were Young and Gay. Her most recently released film is Guest in the House. Although Marie started in show business as a vocalist, she is yet to sing on the screen. But the time may come when she'll be known as the screen's body and voice. And now for station announcements. Bidwill McCormick takes you behind the scenes in Hollywood.
Art, what is it? Well, to the painter, it no doubt means the capturing on canvas the depth of understanding and true lightness of the subject. To the sculptor, a grace and charm and beauty such as to give apparent life and animation to cold-chiseled marble. To the motion picture director and performers, it means the true portrayal of characters and a proper coordination of production settings, lighting, and performance. But to the motion picture press agent, it means but one thing, still pictures. Still pictures are the photographs taken either on the set of a motion picture scene while it is being made, or they are specially posed pictures of stars and players and other persons connected with the production. Primarily, these pictures are made for reproduction, in newspapers and magazines, or for theater lobby display purposes. But almost always, they are for publicity purposes.
Publicity art is divided into many categories, isn't it?
Yes. There's straight publicity art, location shots, candid shots, shots of stars and directors, fashion art, advertising art, and special holiday art. That is, in which a starlet the studio is trying to promote is posed with a firecracker, for instance, the 4th of July, or with a Christmas wreath. This is called a leg art, or cheesecake, usually because the girl is attired in bathing suit or play togs. So, publicity art is much, many, and varied.
Yes, sir, and when one considers the many types of publicity art, the number and style of pictures required, and the angles, and most of them not bad to look at either, being a studio still cameraman is not bad work, if you can get it. A few pictures now before the cameras are the new Frank Sinatra feature, Bar of Music, Radio Stars on Parade, a novelty musical with Wally Brown, Alan Carney, and Francis Langford topping the cast, Ding Dong Williams, the first of a new series based upon the Collier's Magazine stories by Richard English, starring Glenn Vernon and Marcy McGuire, Cornered, and Chicago Lulu. Edward Stevenson, the designer who created Maureen O'Hara's wardrobe for the Technicolor picture, The Spanish Main, has been loaned to 20th Century Fox to design this star's clothes for her next film, Kitten on the Keys. Bill H. Johnson, new Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer actor, has officially changed his name to John Carlyle and has been cast in a featured role in Dangerous Partners. Lucille Ball's gag birthday gift to her husband, Sergeant Desi Arnaz, was a pin-up picture to end all pin-ups. It was of herself, of course, but wearing an old-fashioned bathing suit, 19-5 vintage, and several sizes too large.
Tom Conway is the antithesis in private life of the characters he customarily essays on the screen. He's the hero of RKO Radio's popular Falcon series of detective thrillers, in addition to other redoubtable characters he portrays. Conway off-screen leads a normal, leisurely life, not far from different from that of any other solid American citizen. Nothing mysterious has ever happened to me, he boasts. The most excitement I have is on sets and on location while making movies. This sometimes, I will admit, gets very thrilling, particularly in the chase and fight scenes. But even those are tame compared to what they look like on the screen. A typical day in Conway's life begins at 6:30 in the morning. He arises before his wife and prepares breakfast for the two. Feeds his 4 trained falcons, which he keeps for pets. If he has a studio call, he's on the set at 9 a.m. If there's no studio call, well, he plans a day of rest and quiet at home, plus 2 hours of strenuous exercise. The latter might be tennis, with his brother, George Sanders, also an actor. A few sets of badminton or ping pong with his wife, or a few rounds of cultivating his victory garden. And now, a word from your local announcer.
Bidwell McCormick takes you behind the scenes in Hollywood. I understand that the most neglected and scorned of movie personalities, the stand-ins, have rebelled. And if present plans work out, the stand-ins will receive the recognition they've long lacked, and soon will be spread across the country the full story of their value to the world of cinema make-believe.
Well, the leader in such a movement to pay tribute to the stand-ins is Leon Errol, star of RKO's recent release, What a Blonde, and other comedies for the same producing concern. Errol has, for the past 8 years, worked with the same stand-in, named William J. O'Brien, a slender man, just about the same build and the same degree of baldness as Rubber Legs himself. Errol said recently, "I know from my own experience how vitally important my own stand-in is to me, and I think that stand-ins deserve recognition of their great value to the films and the individual actors."
I understand that Cary Grant, Ginger Rogers, and others have their own permanent stand-ins who've worked with him for a long time, and that the relationship in many cases is very much like that of close friends.
That's the way it is, according to Errol, between himself and O'Brien. More than just the tailor's dummy who stands up to be lighted in place of a star. Errol says that he has relied upon O'Brien for dialogue coaching, cues, wardrobe, accuracy, and a million little details which ordinarily would be only be trusted to a competent manager.
And I understand that O'Brien has appeared on the screen in many of Leon Errol's pictures, too, and when not working with Errol, has taken part in other productions.
Yes, Errol says that the perfect stand-in must be an actor himself, and one of the same general type as the actor for whom he stands in.
Dorothy Sebastian returns to the screen in RKO Radio's musical, George White Scandals of 1945. It was White who gave Miss Sebastian her first job in the theater as one of his Scandals girls in 1924. Eva Novak, a star of the silent films, unseen on the screen since the early 30s, returned to motion pictures in a featured part of The Bells of St. Mary's, first Rainbow production with Bing Crosby and Ingrid Bergman. Gwen Crawford and Betty Gillette, RKO contract players, will enact interned army nurses in First Man into Tokyo. The picture stars Tom Neal with Barbara Hale playing opposite him. Leon Errol and Edgar Kennedy have renewed their RKO contracts. Each will star in 6 comedy short subjects during the coming year.
A tonsillectomy changed Frances Langford from a soprano to a contralto, and incidentally made her the idol of millions. She was born and educated in Lakeland, Florida, and she entered Southern College to major in music and was in great demand at fraternity and sorority parties until a throat inflammation made an operation necessary. She had an anxious time while the chances of her ever singing again hung in the balance. But when she emerged with a smooth, deep contralto voice, her friends urged her to try radio work. Between classes, she went to Tampa to sing over a local station. And at a nearby resort, Rudy Vallee heard her sing and invited her to appear with him as guest star in New Orleans. Rudy's program served as a springboard to fame. She received offers from radio and stage and worked on both. She toured the nation with her own vaudeville troupe and then settled in New York to sing in nightclubs and network programs. She was voted the top radio songstress in almost every popularity poll. In 1941, she joined Bob Hope's radio show in a program that was to become a favorite of millions. The troops in Alaska, England, North Africa, and Italy have heard her singing to the accompaniment of artillery and the drone of fighters circling on guard overhead. She's 5 feet, 2½ inches tall, weighs 100 pounds, has brown eyes and blonde hair. And now a word from your local announcer.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.